The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's podcast, we're looking at how the web has transformed how we look for love and how we look for art. Popping in and out of the studio this week to share their thoughts are digital media correspondent Jemima Kish, technology editor Charles Arthur, and former technology editor and Guardian columnist Vic Keegan. We're speaking with Chris Thorpe, the founder of ArtFinder, a recommendation engine that helps you pinpoint what art you might like based on your existing preferences. I'm also speaking with Sam Yagan, CEO and co-founder of OkCupid, the biggest free internet dating site in the USA. Keep listening for the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. We start this week with the big news. Osama bin Laden was killed by the U.S. military, not by a drone, but by U.S. special forces. Joining me to discuss this is Charles Arthur. Welcome, Charles. What can you tell me about this story?
Well, the fascinating thing is, of course, that they tracked him by the fact that this little compound in the place where he was found had no phone and no internet, which starts to make you think, wow, that's quite a thing to be the signal in a little out-of-the-way place in Pakistan. But it was also the technologies that they used. A lot of people have seen the picture that's on Flickr of the war room, where Obama and Hillary Clinton and various other chiefs of staff are all watching the raid happening live. One of the Navy SEALs who was carrying it out had a camera fixed on the helmet. They were actually following it as it happened. And this was all done by some very effective video systems, satellite systems combined with very encrypted communications channels. So effectively, they're watching it in real time.
Why on earth would they do that? What is the objective of doing that? It feels to me slightly like a Fox broadcast of Cops. You know what I mean? But it's like Cops extreme and only for, you know, Obama and Hillary Clinton.
It's so that you know what's happening. You know, you're the from Obama's point of view, you're the commander in chief. Okay, you've given this the go ahead on this mission. You want to know how it is going, and you want to be able to say, well, you know, these things did happen. He wanted also, I think, to be able to say, yep, that's the guy. I've completely seen it.
It's very, very interesting, though, isn't it, that this notion of control, rather than delegating to, you know, say the commander of the Navy SEALs, the special ops, it's now down to the fact that the president, in this case, Obama, needs to actually, in many ways, be there virtually in order to feel as if he's got the, you know, he's got the knowledge, he's got the information. He's no longer relying upon second or third sources.
But politically, it's huge because he can say, you know, I said, I give the go-ahead. You know, this absolutely came right up the chain of command. And so the fact that he can say, I said, let's go ahead with the mission. You know, he absolutely said, we're not going to do drones. We're not going to, you know, do it by remote control. We are actually going to do it hand to hand. Means that he can claim all the political kudos that follows. And there's some, you know, there's an important element of that as well, which I think is, you know, it's easily overlooked. But this was a big political gamble for him if they'd got it wrong. You know, dropping a drone would have sort of, you know, you could destroy the compound, but you're not certain. This was the way. It's a really big roll of the dice for him in that sense. The technology all enabled it, and we did all go back to that thing where they said no phone, no internet. What is this place?
The other interesting thing technologically is how it was reported and how it diffused. I've seen and heard rumors that it was broken on Twitter. Is that the case?
The first report seemed to have the first sort of widespread media reports, if you like, came out on Twitter. There was one of Donald Rumsfeld, who's the Bush defense secretary. One of his chiefs of staff, a guy called Keith Urban, tweeted at about 25 past 10 that, hey, I heard from a reliable person that they got Osama bin Laden. Hot damn. And he actually said later that his source wasn't within the Rumsfeld or the Bush camp, because Obama had called President Bush, he had called President Clinton and told them about this. But actually, his source was a TV producer. There's also a guy in Abbottabad who is an IT consultant who'd sort of gone up there to get away from Lahore and all the sort of the lousy life in that part of Pakistan. And he started tweeting about it. He said, hey, there's a helicopter overhead. This was about 1 a.m. his time. And he started tweeting, and his live stream of tweets was actually, in effect, reporting the whole firefight, because he was only about 250 meters away from where it all happened.
But unfortunately, we can't always rely upon these types of witnesses. In some of the research that I did for one of the Observer columns looking at news gathering, there have been incidents where people have so-called broken news stories on Twitter, or, you know, they've released content on Twitter that they claim to be true, but is simply spinning a yarn. And then news organizations, whether it's, you know, whether it's TV or newspaper organizations, glom onto that, jump on the back of that, and report it as fact. So why in this case? I mean, it seems very much like the news organizations got lucky. Or do you feel that there's been a sea change in how news organizations, traditional news organizations, treat sources like Twitter, looking, for example, for supporting evidence that an individual's Twitter feed is in fact valid and what they say is true?
This is slightly different because, you know, Obama had seen it happen. Therefore, there's a small enclave within the White House which is already briefed. He told Bush, he told Clinton, so they start to be briefed. So this was solid information right from the top, which started to filter out among the so-called Beltway insiders, you know, the people inside the West Wing sort of group. And that meant that when it started to leak out onto Twitter via TV producers, you know, which is, again, it's mass media, it was already kosher. This wasn't something which sort of welled up from a Navy SEALs tweeting something somewhere and someone picks it up and says, hey, look what I've seen over there. You know, it's the sort of thing where, yes, we're doing it in hindsight and saying, oh, yeah, OK, so that was the tweet. This was the one and this was the person. But it's often that's how these things get done. It's only in hindsight that you're able to say, yeah, that was factual, that was correct, and the other ones were wrong. You can't tell it at the time. And news organizations, it's not as if they've suddenly changed their game. They're not suddenly got better at it. It's just that in this case, the information was coming from the best briefed sources.
Thanks, Charles. And we will have more news headlines later in the program. London-based startup ArtFinder have an uphill struggle as they try to convince art lovers to engage with social media, but they claim to have the answer. Led by Chris Thorpe, ArtFinder aims to be the stabilizers on the bike for art audiences as they appear online for, in some cases, the first time. When I spoke to Chris earlier, I asked him how it all works.
The main thing that we've got there that's really of interest to you is the Magic Tour, where we ask you to pick 3 works out of 12. So we give you 3 screens with 4 pictures on. And depending on which works you pick, we use all sorts of similarity matrices and some collaborative filtering stuff to actually recommend you a whole load of artworks that you might like. It's kind of a curated, filtered, almost serendipity, but not quite serendipity sort of thing. But you get a stream of art, and it's almost like having a radio station or a playlist that you can then look through and say, I like that, I'm not sure I like that.
You've said the magic word, and you know that you've said the magic word, and serendipity. My personal theory is that engines like this that are primarily algorithmically mm-hmm. based, like Amazon's Mechanical Turk, you know, the engines, the recommendations engines that suggest things based upon things that you say you like, actually in some ways reduce serendipity because you're being given exactly what it is that you want.
Well, it's more of a question of how do you discover interesting things in the first place. So I've had a beef as long as I've been involved in stuff to do with the internet about search and filtration is one thing, and actually serendipity is a completely different thing. And you kind of need to discover things serendipitously to know what your tastes are so you can then search and filter by them. So if you've just got search and filtration, then nobody will ever really discover something exciting and new. Nobody really quite understands the wonder of randomness. So if you looked at, so John Peel, probably the best serendipity engine the world has ever known, would have bits that were distinctly curated that he loved. He had bits that were distinctly curated for the audience because he knew a lot about his audience and he knew a lot about the bands. And then there would just be pure randomness or things that appear to be pure randomness. And it's very hard to know as an outsider which bit's which.
Jemima, aesthetic is such a personal experience. How do you think that an engine like ArtFinder will help me to find different things that meet my personal artistic aesthetic?
There are 2 things here. One is there is some danger of reinforcing what you already like, and perhaps maybe you could put a genuinely random image into somebody's selection and say, look, this is a random choice, but do you like it? And, you know, maybe expand people's horizons that way. But I think quite an important function of Art Finder will be to add a bit more context, because you can often find a picture or an artist or a series of work that you're really fascinated by, but you don't know much about it. And if you can contextualise that and give a little bit of art history, and also help identify what a work is, because you might see a piece that's been used somewhere. And that's an incredibly important part of the picture, and I know that's a really powerful part of Art Finder as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's something that we haven't demonstrated publicly, but if you know us and you venture into our rather shabby offices in Holborn, we might show you, which is how to use image recognition to recognise paintings. So we've got somebody who I think he works magic, really, who does lots of vision stuff, and he's tuned his image recognition stuff for flat art at the moment, but he's working on sculpture as well. And the great thing about that is that you then get the chance of having something in a gallery that acts as almost like your personal flight data recorder for gallery visits. So you can go around and you say, I really like that. Tell me what it is.
It's a Shazam.
It's a Shazam for art.
For art.
Will the galleries let you use your mobile phone in that way? Because they clamp down on you in London, not in Paris.
I think it depends on where you are. So, and if you look in the US, then there's no restriction at all. I was lucky enough to be in MoMA the other week. We were at a show called Museums and the Web, and I've never seen quite so many phones and cameras, big, huge SLRs being aimed at pictures. And when you talk to any of the people, so I did some COD anthropology, you'd have been horrified by Alex. And I sort of said, what are you doing? They all said, we're making a record of what we've seen. We're keeping a visual scrapbook, almost, of what they've seen. And so that's what we think these mobile phone devices are all about. It's about, you know, I've seen that, I want to record it, I'll come back to it later. I might want to know which art books it's in so I can buy them. I want to know if I can get a print of it. I might want to know what other art I might like or other museums I might like if I go to a different city.
But also, for the purposes of Art Finder, it's about building up your database of art. At the moment, it's nascent. You don't have the entirety of the art collections of the world.
We're busy, but not that busy. Yeah.
But also, at the same time, there is a definition. Jemima, you sort of alluded to this. There is a definition of what art is, and how are you going to populate your database? And once you populated it or started this process, how are you going to contain it? What are your boundaries for what art is?
So how we're populating it is respectfully. I think that's the safest thing to say. So we're respectful of rights, both of museums and of artists and things like that. We want to work with them. We want this to be a long-term sustainable venture where it's a partnership with the museums and the galleries and the artists. In terms of containing it and what art is, the initial criteria we've said is if you're a major museum or an art gallery, or you're one of the top tier of galleries or a top tier art school, that's good for us. So that's where curation and sitting in this building here, we're all about curation, comes in.
How many of the major galleries you've got? You've got the National Gallery and the Tate.
We don't yet have the Tate totally on board. We've got some of their images. Again, we're working through all of the different galleries, talking to them, being very respectful, you know, telling them what we want to do, what our intentions are and how we want to involve them and get them on board. We've got people like the Ashmolean in Oxford signed up. We're working with the Art Gallery Ontario in Canada. We're talking to people like Brooklyn Museum and, you know, several other of the American galleries that we met out there. And people like Balboa Park, who recently have been getting lots of plaudits for their use of Creative Commons.
So you've got some amazing partners on board.
Yeah.
You've certainly got a very impressive roster of staff. When I walked into your office not so long ago, I couldn't believe how many familiar faces were in there.
Well, you can't run our principle of one startup per person if you don't have that sort of team.
Well, pretty much what you're doing, because it's a very ambitious project. But I have to ask, where's the money going to come from?
We think that people, when they have a chance to have a legitimate relationship with a gallery or an artist, will happily buy things. And at the moment, one of the biggest problems is knowing where you can buy things to do with art. Amazon, fantastic bookstore, doesn't do brilliantly on art monographs. We can fix that because we can say, well, you seem to like this artist, so we can sell you the book through the partnerships we're building there. In addition, there are all these fantastic treasure troves you've come across, like lithographs. And you find they're amazing limited edition lithographs that nobody quite knows where to buy them. So, for instance, if you went to the Yorkshire Sculpture Park a couple of years ago, there's an amazing Noguchi show. and there were Noguchi lithographs there. But the Noguchi fans wouldn't know they were there. So one thing we can try and do is try and direct people to places where they can buy art.
On a
revenue share basis. And that moves into, you know, primary art market eventually as well. I mean, I don't think we're going to ever be selling, you know, £50,000, £100,000 pieces of art over the web. But lots of artists find it really hard to market their work, sell their work, and get their name known.
Chris, what's your forward motion? What's your launch plan?
So we're just about to submit our first set of coffee table apps for the iPad and for other tablets. And these are, I mean, you talked about serendipity earlier, and I think one of the interesting things about serendipity, and we all know that this happens with printed newspapers, is they're a bundle of stuff, and you get it all in one go. And so you want to finish it, you can finish it, unlike the internet or the whole catalogue of art or whatever. And so the apps that we're producing are very much they're an exhibition guide, or they're a single artist monograph, or they're the sort of things that you'd find in bookshops, but lots of exciting stuff. I mean, for instance, we're doing some stuff with the AGO in Toronto, where they've taken some really beautiful deadpan images of gallery walls. And we've got somebody working in the office, and it's his first project since he's joined us, where you just tap on the picture and it tells you what it is. And it's ridiculously simple. But it feels, because of the quality of the images and the quality of the screen here, it feels way more compelling than walking through 3D environments, say. And so I think, you know, we're thinking about lots of ways where we can make the interaction between you and art simpler, so that we can gain more insight into what it is that you love, and we can then recommend you more stuff and drive you to more real-world exhibitions and to explore more artists.
Chris Thorpe. Now, here's Charles with the news.
Google's offices in South Korea have been raided following claims that its mobile advertising unit, AdMob, illegally collected location data about users without their consent. It's the latest installment in the row over smartphones and privacy, which was sparked off a fortnight ago, when two British researchers revealed that Apple's iPhone keeps a file that effectively retains a record of your movements. A South Korean police official said they suspected AdMob collected personal location information without consent or approval from the Korean Communication Commission. Google said it is cooperating with the investigation. Sony has suffered another breach of an online network. This time, around 25 million credit card details may have been stolen after the systems for the Sony Online Entertainment Network, used for PC internet gaming, were attacked. Sony has discovered that the break-in happened sometime on the 16th or 17th of April, before the one which forced it to close down the PlayStation Network. That is still not restored, and the 77 million users have been warned that any credit card details they supplied may have been stolen as well. The Guardian has received anecdotal reports of people seeing fraud on cards that were used on the PlayStation Network. A report by two non-governmental organisations, the Centre for Research on Multinational Corporations and Students and Scholars Against Corporate Misbehaviour, says the 500,000 workers at the factories of Foxconn in China are treated like machines. They say the workers are obliged to work overtime, live in crowded conditions, and publicly humiliated. Foxconn makes equipment for companies including Apple and Dell. The reports say the workers, trying to meet the huge demand for the first iPad last year, were sometimes pressured to take only one day in 13 off. And ebook sales in the UK have risen by 20% to £108 million, according to the Publishers Association. That's against a backdrop of an increase in total sales, including digital products and physical books, of 2% to £3.1 billion. That makes ebooks worth just under 6% of the market, but growing very much more quickly year on year. Best-selling authors included Stephen Fry, Stieg Larsson, and James Patterson.
Thanks, Charles. You can read up on these stories and the latest headlines throughout the week at guardian.co.uk/technology. The recent royal nuptials were described as the first internet wedding, mostly because they were live-streamed on YouTube. Of course, a cynic like me might argue that there has been no YouTube for any previous weddings. But it remains that William and Kate did get hitched in a very different era than Charles and Diana did in 1981. The rules of engagement have changed. Or, so Sam Yagan, CEO and co-founder of OkCupid, the US's largest free dating site, maintains. I spoke with Sam to research last Sunday's Untangling the Web column for the Observer newspaper. I began by asking him about the kinds of people using the site and what makes OkCupid so different?
The most of our users are 18 to 34. About two-thirds of our users are under 34. And that's roughly in line with the single population in the U.S. So I think what you'll find is rather than the subscription sites that target people who are specifically online daters, I think the OkCupid user base targets daters generally because it's free, because it's a much more relaxed, low-pressure environment. A lot of people who typically haven't been online daters in the past are attracted to the sort of bar feel, the pub feel that we try to build at OkCupid.
Well, that actually is a very interesting element, isn't it? Because especially when you're thinking about, the people who are in their late teens, early 20s, why would you think that they would go to online dating? Surely there is an abundance of single people out there with whom they can connect in meet space, as it were.
Right. I think online dating used to be something that people turned to when they were giving up on offline dating. And not just OkCupid, I think this is happening across the industry, but I think OkCupid is probably the at the forefront of this. It is now a tool that people are turning to complement their offline dating. So you may be a 23-year-old attractive woman who's getting lots of dates offline, but why not, at no cost and in a fun way, make yourself available to many, many other people who you might not meet in your day-to-day life?
One of the elements that I see when it comes to online dating is this notion of building a profile. Yes, I understand that when people go to the pub or when they go to gigs or when they, when they go to restaurants or whatever, they are building a persona that's based upon, their dress and what they say and how they look. But when it comes to creating a profile on a dating site, that's quite a static entity, isn't it? So there's a lot of personal marketing that goes on.
Well, I think regardless of how you do it, when you're meeting someone new, it is a little bit of marketing. You are putting your best foot forward. There is a guardedness, there is a management that anyone has the first time they meet another person, whether it's a job, whether it's a friend of a friend, or whether it's a potential date.
But this notion of the profile, it is a very sort of static entity, isn't it? Or do you see that people change and adapt their profiles according to who they think is looking, the types of responses that they get? I mean, how adaptive are people when it comes to how they present themselves for dating and the love market?
That has changed over the last decade. 10 years ago, profiles, online dating profiles, were very static. You would do it once. You would fill everything out, and then you would just kind of let your profile sit in the pool and see what happens. But a couple things have happened to change that. One is with the rise of Facebook and Twitter, people are used to constantly updating their presence. And while we're not a social network, and while Twitter's not a dating site, the concept of constantly of keeping your online presence fresh and updated is something that has permeated people's mindsets. So in part because of that, people are constantly updating their online dating profiles. And second, online dating sites have started to promote that. We've started to incentivize that. So for example, if you update your profile, you actually end up being surfacing more highly in the search results because you have now changed your profile, you have new information. We want to show that to new people. You actually will get better distribution of your profile the more you update it.
I want to talk a little bit about the research that you've done, and I'll do that in a second because that's really interesting. But one of the key elements of any dating site is how it matches people. And I understand by your tagline, you do this with math. Tell me a bit about that. Tell me a little bit about how you can reduce this emotion of love to a computer algorithm.
Sure. Well, OkCupid is what happens when four math majors start a dating site. So for better or for worse, other dating sites are started by psychologists, started by other kinds of people with different theories about dating, and we are a bunch of mathematicians who think we think we're onto something. Our biggest difference is that we don't think we know anything about dating. And in fact, we don't think anyone knows enough about dating to have the one bulletproof algorithm that's going to work for everyone. So what we do is we have built our entire system, rather than trying to model some formula we have in our heads, we try to model the existing way that people decide who to go on dates with. And the best way to explain that, if one of your girlfriends called you up and said, "I've got a great guy I want to set you up on a date with," no matter how much you trust her, she could be your very best friend, you're not just going to say yes to that date. Instead, you're going to ask her questions. You're going to have a set of questions that you care about. It might be about religion. It might be about video games. It might be about pets. It might be about kids. It might be about sex. It might be about drugs. You're going to have a set of things that you care about. And for those set of things that you care about, you're going to have your own preferences, and you're going to be looking for different things in your potential dates. And so what we've done is simply provide a platform for people to tell us what's important to them, tell us about themselves, and to tell us what they're looking for. And in that way, each person can customize our platform to work for themselves rather than trying to make themselves work for an existing algorithm.
One of the things that I've discovered about, speaking with people who do online dating and also people who run online dating sites, is that when you ask people what it is that they want, they very rarely actually know what it is that they want. And given that that's an important part of your algorithm, how do you get people to open up and actually identify what it is that they want?
I think what people don't know about is what they want conceptually. They don't know, you know, what kind of person they want. And the reason for that is that there are lots of different kinds of people that somebody would want, right? There's not just one. Some people believe that there's only one soulmate for you, but I think most people believe that there's a whole bunch of people that you could get along with in a good relationship. And that's why we don't ask open-ended questions like, you know, who's the perfect person for you? We ask things like, do you enjoy video games? And people know whether they enjoy video games, and people know whether they want to date someone who likes video games. You may hate video games, and you may say, gosh, the last thing I want to do is date someone who plays video games for 3 hours a day. And so at a very granular level, you can give me little bits of information, any one of which is not that important, and any one of which you have a lot of confidence in your answer to. And then when I aggregate them over hundreds of these questions, I can look for the trends, the patterns, and the correlations that are going to predict that you're going to get along on your first date.
Speaking of the trends and the patterns, the OK Trends blog, or rather it's the OK Cupid blog that has all of the trends and all of the number crunching based upon this enormous sample that you guys have managed to get through your population, through your customer base. What do the trends say? What does the research say about what a perfect match is?
Wow.
Now, I mean, given today's marketplace, right? And when I say marketplace, I mean both the sort of the singles marketplace as well as the marketplace of the social environment that we're in, where online dating is you know, as valid as offline dating is, which is a shift from the past over the past decade.
Sure. I think what we know is that there's no one perfect answer to that question. And in fact, that it changes for different people. It changes for different people at different times in their lives. And that's part of why we think that having such a flexible system is so important.
Some of the other research that you've done, though, has been really interesting in terms of finding out about our relationship with potential strangers, potential lovers. So, a very widely distributed piece of the research that you did was about how you identify somebody who's attractive based on their profile picture. Can you talk a little bit about how you found that and what the results were based on and ultimately what the results were?
If you're going out on a first date, you spend a lot of time thinking about what you look like. You spend a lot of time thinking about what you're wearing. You know, you take a shower, you brush your teeth, you do all those things to get ready. And in kind of a similar way, the photo that you decide to use in an online dating profile is often carefully selected in the same way, right? You want all the same attributes you want to have of a first impression in real life, you also want to have when you're making a first impression online. And so we did some research. We looked at 7,000 accounts and their pictures, and we figured out what it was that drove pictures in particular to be considered attractive. And, you know, one of my favorite findings from that report was that if you use a flash, you look 7 years older than someone who doesn't use a flash. So the first thing you can do to make yourself look better online is
take a picture of yourself in the dark.
Well, not in the dark. You just simply in natural lighting. Don't use the flash.
So it sounds to me like just there is a shift. Online dating and the pursuit of love has been transformed by the web. What effect do you think that this is going to have in the long term?
One of the most interesting effects of online dating is that it brings much more diversity to relationships. Offline dating is constrained by physical realities of space. You typically, in the real world, date people who are near you. or who are in the same routines that you are. Either they go to the same gym, they go to the same school, they go to the same church, they go to the same place of employment. And so immediately, what online dating does is it brings you into people that aren't in part of your daily routine, who aren't living in your exact same neighborhood, going to the same schools, churches, and gyms. And in that case, you're going to get more diverse relationships. That's the easiest thing to prove.
But this is despite the algorithm that you guys well, put into place.
Well, it's not despite the algorithm. It's I think, because of the algorithm. I mean, just because someone is similar to you along those attributes of socioeconomics and geography doesn't mean that you guys are perfect for each other romantically. And in fact, there are, you know, it's quite often the case that opposites attract, or it's quite often the case that, you know, what you need to complement your life is not someone I just like you. I mean, if I married someone exactly like me, I would shoot myself. And I think that is exactly part of the reason that online dating works so well. Another thing that's interesting is because the pool of people is so large in online dating sites, if you spend a few months looking through that pool of people, you can feel pretty good that when you find the best person on that out of that whole group, you can be pretty confident they're a really good match for you. If you marry your high school sweetheart, you might have only had 200 other people in your school, and the one best person out of 200 might very well not be as good a choice as the best person out of 2 million on a dating site.
That was Sam Yakin from OkCupid. You can read more on the topic of online love in last Sunday's Observer. And you can also hear the full interview with Sam and see the other primary sources I found in the making of the column, including the latest psychological research on the offline effects of online love at guardian.co.uk/UTTW. That's it for this week. Many thanks to my various studio guests, Vic Keegan, Charles Arthur, and Jemima Kish. Thanks as well to ArtFinder's Chris Thorpe and OkCupid's Sam Yakin. The producer on this week's podcast was Matt Hill. I'm Alex Kratosky. We are back next Tuesday. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.